everybody. This is the TCP. I am John Stamp. Tonight, Tiger is with me, but his eyes are already fluttering, so I don't think we're going to hear much from him tonight. Nothing big from me before we get into to chatting about some really fun couple of novellas that I stumbled into. One thing, though, I am wrapping up Blood Red Ivory 2. The Tyrone Benhoff part 2, still untitled, because as I've mentioned before, I suck at writing blurbs and I suck at writing titles. So but I'm pretty sure I got like 10,000 to go, and then I got a couple rounds of editing, and then I go see what the publisher thinks of it. So more to follow on that. Also, the TCP IG is approaching 1,000 followers. I've never been one to see or care how many people follow me, but since that number's hanging over my head, I kind of want to get there. So if you haven't hit follow yet at That's Criminal Podcast and would like to help me jump over that hill, have at it. And also, while you're doing that, like and subscribe to TCP, and just because, why not? It's a competition, right? Might as well see how many we can get. And that's whatever platform you stream, Apple, Spotify, there's like a dozen of them out there. I can't even think of all of them. So, but that's it. Give me a hand and I would appreciate it. But enough of that administrative nonsense. Tonight, we're going to talk to FX Reagan. FX Reagan was a police officer in a major metropolitan police department and an FBI special agent and SWAT team member. He retired more than 33 years of law enforcement service and retired as a special agent in charge in SAC of a large FBI field division. The novella that I stumbled onto, Project Area 51 Project Sapphire, is a trio. There's Area 51 Project Onyx. They're the beginning of a series that was super fun because it involves a homicide out of no place other than Area 51. It's right in the title. The third one should be coming out in June. In addition to these pretty unique novellas that I found, FX has also written two full-length novels surrounding a dismissed FBI agent turned PI, CJ Hawk, involving murder, conspiracy, and rogue government operations in and around DC. Third is in development, and all are inspired by actual events, including murders in the nation's capital. And as if that's not enough, he's got another series pending featuring a Fairfax County detective, Kiki Diaz, in production as we go. First novella from that one should be coming out in the fall of 23. So with all that, he actually found time to come join me. So FX, thanks for joining me, and floor is yours.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be on the podcast.
Absolutely. My first note, so Area 51 takes place, you know, post, very fresh post World War II, the perfect setting in my mind. My first note was that this novella feels like Bud from LA Confidential stumbles into a NASA meeting.
That's good. That's really good.
Yeah. There's just not enough noir in the world. So that setting, just how did you land on going into that point in time to start?
Okay, so I love noir. I kind of like the concept, I guess, maybe because I'm a cynic by nature, which the job will do to you, for former coppers and feds out there. And I was fascinated by Area 51. I think it's kind of a neat area of, no pun intended, a neat area of mystery. And everybody is, you know, at an allure of what's going on out there. And I actually wrote those novellas after I completed the first two full-length novels, the CJ Hawk novels that are out there. They're both with an editor and a couple agents taking a look at them as well. So while that is going on, while the editor kind of spiffs these things up and we try and get, you know, a really good A-list agent, which is tough to do, as any writer would know, I kind of wanted to fill my time with something. And so I thought, you know, Area 51 is kind of a neat concept, what goes on out there. I know police work. So I kind of came up with this concept of a crusty old Washington, D.C. detective, you know, my hero, John Block, Jack Morrison, who gets sent out there against his will, And as you know from reading the first one, it involves kind of a serial murderer out there at Area 51. It's kind of too sensitive for people who control Area 51 to investigate themselves. They don't want to call the feds in. So guy that runs security out there reaches out for an old friend of his who's a chief in the Washington Metropolitan DC Police Department, asks for help. The chief has just the man. Black Jack Morrison is kind of a troublemaker, always on the bubble. And so as punishment, he gets set out there to solve this series of two homicides, and does in pretty quick order. And, you know, I thought it was kind of fun. I had a fun time putting it together. And so I decided to do another one and then the third one. And I've literally got an outline on paper for a fourth as well.
Yeah. As long as the ideas keep coming, right? Mm-hmm. In the, that novella format, it's like this actual podcast ended up being the evolution from a blog that in hindsight was probably pretty terrible, but I could not write the short fiction thing. I could knock out 100,000 words, but to wrap, I had a buddy who wanted me to, he was doing a anthology and he needed like a 5,000 word story, something horror, which I can do. I got the dark side. I could outline it out, but I could not wrap that thing up within that window. And I know in a novella, you got some more room to play with, but me in that short genre has just never been something I was good at. So I don't, but the way you put these out, they're just nice episodics, you know, and that's, you know, you get to know Morrison, and I love, you know, the part that we're just post World War II. Everybody around them in that DC metro area is a little bit messed up. Everybody's pretty much a functioning alcoholic and just trying not to circle the drain too fast.
Correct.
And as you mentioned, like his bosses are pretty much, which was one of my favorite points that you made, was that these guys are all OSS guys. So they're just like, yeah, we're super spies, and some of them are still super spies. His boss is a lieutenant in the homicide division, but they all have that super spy background that you just know there's like the whole background of those guys too. There's so much depth to the people that you created, even though they're relatively minor characters, just that setting just allows all of that.
Well, that was fun. And yeah, to your point, the first one, Project Sapphire, takes place in 1955. The second one, Project Onyx, takes place in 1963, and there's a little bit of the Kennedy assassination woven in there that readers will find. The third one that'll come out in June takes place in 1969, and there's a little bit of the moon landing spun in there. And then the one that I'm thinking about, and I don't want to give too much away, is going to be like 1971, 72 timeframe. So I got to be careful how I age out John Black Jack Morrison, but I think I can do it, and I don't think too many things changed, at least with him and the policing world and what he deals with in that time frame.
Yeah, and it's, you know, starting it out in 55, you've still got that, like I alluded to, LA Confidential, you've just got that wild, pretty much people were still figuring out what their constitutional rights meant. So it's kind of wide open, you know?
Right.
I was talking to, who was it? I had... one of the people I talked to last year, we had a great conversation because they were writing in that period. It was a true crime thing. Oh, it was, wasn't Sadler. Might've been Sadler. But it was basically a guy who was a fugitive hiding out in a barn and took out this couple, but then had so many appeals based on the way they ran his interrogation, the way they processed him, that they violated so many rights. And it was like the first time this agency had run up against somebody with an actual defense attorney.
Right.
And they're like, wait, we set the precedent for this. Oh no, we set precedent again. Appeals court got us. We just set another precedent, you know? So it's just that time in law enforcement is such a wild time that it lends to a lot of freedom that, you know, nowadays probably would not be, I mean, you don't have a shot really.
Well, no, because everything they do is recorded, video and audio. Yeah. So I mean, part of the fun of that, and in my first CJ Hawk novel takes place in 1985, 1986, 1991. And writing, you know, before we had all this technology is fun for me because you get a lot more into the human dynamic there. We're not talking about cell phones. You know, detectives and private eyes can't just, you know, geolocate everybody. They can't pick up the phone and call everybody. They got to go use a payphone. They got to figure out a way to meet somebody. And that's a lot of fun. Maybe it's because I grew up in that sort of period. And, you know, by the time I left law enforcement, of course, all these things had come along. But the real, you know, human element, the human factor takes place, I think, in especially storytelling pre-technology. It's too easy to, I don't say it's easy to solve crimes today. It's easier, I'll tell you that, with all the technology. So you really have to, these detectives really have to work it. And I like that.
Yeah, and they have to be able to talk. They have to be able to talk their way into places and out of places.
Right,
and that is quickly becoming a lost art. You know, it's really unfortunate. But you know, a lot of times, especially my background, ended up more towards the personal crime elements. But once you grab somebody's phone, you pretty much got them. You know, as long as they don't have something, as long as Apple decides not to let them stay encrypted. You know,
right. If you can get in there.
Yeah. But, you know, as far as like just doing basic surveillances and talking your way out of places when people are asking what you're doing, people don't have to concentrate on that as much anymore. And it's a different thing. But yeah, I see the advantages would be, you know, the advantages today, because I got some time out of the field at this point. But, you know, today it's all so app driven and everybody is basically like the highest speed digital forensics guy from 10 years ago. That's a rookie coming out of the academy at this point. They got them. It takes away from the human element a little bit, like you said.
I have a feeling, and I saw a lot of it toward the end of my career, detectives and federal agents, I think, spend a lot of time in the office behind a screen. That's where the evidence is now. That's where the leads are. But it's just, that's a lot different than being out, you know, on the bricks, as they call it, or, you know, knocking on doors, talking to people. And they're effective. I'm not being critical of them, but, you know, driving around with a roll of quarters and a can of Lysol to use a payphone, a lot to be said for that.
That right. Yep. Yeah. It's just different. I don't sit still well. So I have to be out when me not being out in the street would drive me a little bit insane if it was when I was stuck at a desk. So
not to jump around too much, but you know, the second CJ Hawk novel I completed is with an editor looking, you know, agents looking at it. It's called Zulu Center. What I do there is talk about the problem with technology. It centers around, you know, a rogue operation that gets set up, Zulu Center. And I don't want to give too much away yet, but the center exists to manipulate DNA for undercover officers, special operators, things like that, because that is such a problem today. You know, it's not really easy for a special operator, CIA officer, undercover FBI agent to go in and out of a scenario where they can't get found out. You know, your passport is all digital face, you know, prints, things like that. So what I approach in Zulu Center is what can go wrong? You know, when for a very good reason, the government decides to set up a center that manipulates people's ID, including turning on and off DNA that doesn't really belong to them. And then that can go really wrong when the scenario unfolds. And that's what I did with that second CJ Hawk novel and how he kind of unravels what went wrong.
Yeah. And give me 1 second. Tiger has just decided he's leaving. So I mean,
okay, well,
let this guy out of here. I'll be right back.
Got it.
Come on, big kid. Sorry, he's usually sleeping by now. He's usually sleeping by now, but not
that's all right. Yeah. I got two of them running around here if you hear any barking. So
it's they're worth it. but yeah, okay. So when you said that, I immediately like defaulted to Tropic Thunder. We're like Robert Downey Jr. Turning himself into a black man so he could get into character. The great thing about that whole DNA, you know, mapping the genome, there's so much potential there. I've never thought about, you know, what the undercovers would think. Be like, yeah, you're great right now, but we're gonna make you tie for the next 2 weeks. you know,
right?
Yeah, you turn an Irishman Thai and be like, God, I'm not cool with that. You know, I'll go do some deals and I'll meet with some bad people, but I really don't want you turning me into somebody else.
Right.
I wonder what the, I don't know. That's a tough question. I mean, you've worked with a bunch of people. The undercover people are a different kind of person. Like they just are. And cause I know I could never do it. But I actually wonder if offered, which how many of them would be like, yeah, let's go. How long is this going to take?
Yeah. Give me everything false. And I ran an undercover in the 90s when it was just starting to become a problem. We worried about, you know, backstopping credit cards, social security numbers. And we had all that. The Bureau had figured it out. But today it's, you know, 20 years later, 30 years later. So there's so much more technology out there that can trap you.
And we've had so many data breaches that, you know, before you even decide you want to become a certified undercover, the opponents already probably have your, if we're working CI, they probably already got all your information.
Oh yeah.
I don't know how many times I've gotten ID Protect sponsored by the federal government.
You know? Exactly. Me too.
Yeah. But yeah, that's a very interesting take. I'm looking forward to that. But that, you know, sticking with the same topic, the technology piece, you working in the 50s, you know, you've got a couple crime scenes there. You've got some forensics considerations. Did you have any trouble while you were writing these particular parts of the investigation and not overstepping the technology of the period?
I don't think so. Because what I really focused on in the first one was sort of the profiling angle. And everybody knows what that is now. Sort of a premise that I had for the 50s was that, you know, profiling existed because cops are cops. I mean, they see a couple of things, they put two and two together and say, hey, this is four. But what they didn't have was what happens in Kansas City, what happens in Chicago, what happened in Arizona, New York, Washington, D.C. And, you know, flash forward to the late 70s, early 80s, when profiling really became a thing. The ability to talk to your fellow officers and agents across the country and compare notes and things like that are what really brought the profiling to the forefront. And we see in, you know, Project Sapphire, there's Jack Black, who's a smart guy, and there's a smart ME at an Air Force base. That between the two of them, they kind of come up with, hey, we've seen this before. This is a profile of a serial killer, and maybe he's done it before. Again, we don't give too much away, but that's, you know, where Jack takes it.
Yeah, and you managed to rope in a couple really good historical whodunits into that as part of the profile, which
right,
was
right.
Always entertaining, you know.
Sure.
So that's the one thing as I was reading, I was like, I wonder if, you know, he's thinking, you know what I really need is a blue light. Like, oh wait, no, that's 30 years too yeah. soon, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just funny. So they got, I don't want to give too much away from it, but with the Area 51, you alluded to a couple places in Area 51 that, like, even the bosses would disappear into a deep dark hole if they even broached.
Right.
And you've always got that on the backside, you know, the that whole being Area 51 and being alluded to the whole UFO thing. You stick to known technology so far. Is there? Now, I don't want you to give anything away, but is there? Are you ever going to play into that that sci-fi zone?
Oh, 100%. So yeah, you get into the second one, Onyx. He learns a little bit more about what's going on in 27 Alpha and 27 Bravo. And then you flash forward to book three, which is called Project Lunar Dust. And all is supposedly unveiled to him, where they tell him, okay, here's what's really going on here. And he may or may not believe it. We'll see at the end, and we might see in future books whether or not he's just being fed a line of bull or what that is.
Awesome.
You know, what he's told is actually what's going on there. So, yeah.
Yeah, there's so much potential there, especially with the, you know, mixing that noir and then blending that sci-fi side, that there's a lot to be played around with in that space.
Yep.
That's awesome. Yeah. So with, three novels, three novellas, were you always carrying a notebook with you? Like, when did you start? Were you, were you writing since you were a kid, or is it something that just kind of came to you at some point you wanted to try? Or,
well, I've always been a reader. You know, growing up reading books, Hardy Boys, and you know, whatever was out there. I mean, not nose buried in a book. In fact, that probably the least amount of reading I ever did was in college. I probably should have been reading and not partying. But yeah, always interested in, of course, being in law enforcement, I was drawn to, you know, Joseph Wamba, love the Michael Connelly stuff. And I've just always been like that. And to answer your question, thought, you know, post law enforcement career, I would, you know, do some writing. And I started out, put together a, you know, kind of a nonfiction, my life in law enforcement. I've read so many crummy books like that. I just figured that didn't really seem to do it. I mean, there's nothing I can go back and talk about my career and, you know, such and such a date I was this. And then I went to Quantico and scored a 280 on the firearm. It just doesn't work. But I scratched it out. I mean, I put together some stories, the things that really happened. You know, you've been in law enforcement a long time. You know that things just happen that are, you know, sad, funny, tragic, all of the above, and they make great stories. But they didn't, when I wrote it out as sort of a, you know, autobiography, it just didn't work. And so I just thought, well, how would this look in fiction? Let me take some of these stories, you know, put them into a larger arc. That first CJ Hawk book that I wrote, 90% of that book is all true. It just happens to be out of order, out of place. It didn't happen in this city or that city. But they're all, you know, every little vignette is something that I really saw, heard, experienced, you know, and it just, I've got a lot of great things to work with. So,
yeah. Yeah. I was always, I've always been worried about getting names and making things a little too, too dead on, you know, so right, I've always tried to stay. I didn't want to copy down, you know, cases.
Right.
But because I'd be afraid I'd get either my subject in there or I'd put like another detective I worked with in there. So I've tried to be cognizant of not like you said, you know, put it out of place, do stuff like that. But yeah.
Here's another challenge with that, John. If you put too much of it that's real, people won't buy it. I mean, you know, you see stuff that
I think it's ridiculous.
If you wrote it word for word, it's the way it came down. People go, it's not true. That couldn't happen that way.
It couldn't happen.
I mean, I was talking with my editor just a couple of weeks ago. We were talking about the case out in Idaho of, you know, the killer that went in and killed four college students. You put that in a timeline of what happened and exactly when with a PhD criminology student and made it fiction. People would go, this couldn't happen. I mean, nobody's that stupid to do what he did here or open to do what he did there. It just doesn't make sense. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, fiction is harder than truth because you got to make it believable.
Yeah. And that's it's when, you know, when you mentioned you were, you know, scratching out the autobiography, all the different things that happen. When I've looked at that, I've always thought that the best thing to do would be a blooper reel, especially from like, you know, the just insane things that happen on patrol. The random conversations that start on a long-term surveillance, you know, just, you know, cracking up with a subject in the back of a car and during a transport or something, all those just crazy things that people will be like, yeah, you're making all this up. Like this does not happen. You guys are in a serious profession. It's like, no, not really.
Right. Right.
You get down to it, but yeah, but the same thing is like, you know, the guys from back in the day would be cracking up, but like the random person picking up be like, yeah, these guys are all either clowns or this is fiction.
Right.
<You know? laughs> Yeah.
There was you maybe saw today on Twitter, there was Tom Colgan, who's an editor at Penguin, does like a little, you know, blog every day. And today he wrote about Barney Miller and how it was the best TV show for those of us that kind of remember that era. And it was a comedy, you know, and these guys basically just sat around the detective room in NYPD and, you know, shot the shit and talked about what was going on. There was no shootouts. There was no hostage situations. There was no action or anything like that, but it was pretty realistic. That's what they did. They sat around the coffee machine, talked about how to solve cases, talked about all the problem people in the department and on the street and all of that. Might've been the most accurate police show in history.
Yeah. I still remember that when I was a little kid, very little. I remember that one.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, that's the best part of law enforcement. I think that's, you know, capturing the ridiculousness is just the best part, you know?
Yeah. Wamba made $1 million doing that.
Yeah.
You know, he took his 15 years in LAPD. I have a friend of mine, former agent, who was also an LAPD officer before he came to the Bureau. Wamba, after he wrote the first book, left the department so he could write full time, hung out at a cop bar so he could keep up with what's going on. He literally bring his notebook in there, talk to the cops, write down the little vignettes that they're talking about, go back and spin them into novels. It's all true.
Yeah. And they're classics. And yeah, just the way he spins them in, that's, Wamba was Choir Boys, one of the first books I got into when I was decided that this is what I was going to do. It was going to be in law enforcement. And that just cracked me up just nonstop. Yeah. But even when you're reading it, you're just like, nah, there's, come on, you know?
Yeah.
Yep. So, speaking of how you ever started it, do you carry around a notebook with you? How do you go about, deciding you've got Blackjack Morrison and you're going to send him to Area 51? Where does that, how do you come up with your ideas?
I think I just come up with a major, kernel of an idea and, you know, just kind of spin it from there. And I've done, you know, I go back and forth between, you know, outlining, like doing really detailed outline and just doing seat of my pants stuff. For these novellas, I really just kind of fly with the idea because it's only, I think they're no more than 25,000 words. And I don't have a problem with them. Frankly, I fear more the 100,000 words than I do the 25,000 words. So I kind of have a beginning, a middle, and an end in mind. I know how this is going to go. And then I just let, you know, the characters kind of fill in, you know, how it goes. So I don't really, I don't notebook it out ahead of time. What I do is keep notes as I'm going. I have like a, you know, master Excel spreadsheet with every character, every place, every weapon. The CJ Hawk novels have a lot of bourbons and books in them. So every time I do one of those, I'll flip over to the Excel spreadsheet and make sure I note it so I can go back and look later. Guns, every... Yep. 1911 I ever put in there, I put down the specs and things like that so that I know where it was and how I used it and all of that. But yeah, for the novellas, I just kind of let the, you know, I just let the story fill in the beginning, middle, and end. And 25,000 words is about 100 pages. And, you know, I'm not wedded to 25 even, and I'm not really pacing myself to make it end right there just to make sure you get enough in there, enough detail, that you have a flavor for the character. The important characters, some of them you're just not going to have time to really learn about, and just let that go.
So I guess you'd kind of be a hybrid. You take notes, but you don't have a defined roadmap that's going to get you from A to Z.
On the longer novels, the three that I'm working, well, the two that I did and one I'm working on, and I learned this from Jack Carr, you know, who's been pretty damn successful. He sits down and does a executive outline. And, you know, maybe it's a page and a half of the story, the main character of the story, really down and dirty page and a half. Do that. And then I put down just like some bullet points of stuff that I really think I need to cover throughout the story. And then I continue to add to it as I'm going. So if I think of an idea in the middle of writing, go back to that outline and just put a bullet point of that. And then more importantly, I keep that sort of, I call it a reverse outline. So for like chapter one, I'll put a synopsis of what happened in chapter one, chapter two, a little synopsis of what happened that. So after every chapter, I'm going back to the outline because, you know, if you get to, you know, 60, 70,000 words, you kind of forget what happened, where it happened. So I'll just go back, you know, to my reverse outline and say, oh yeah, that chapter 17, CJ Hawk went to the police station in Alexander and he learned this. And okay, now refresh my recollection, go back to where I'm at and plug in the details. So
yeah, that's like my morning summary. Like I'll get my writing time done one morning, and then before I get back to it, either before I head out to work or before I start typing, I'll look at that last chapter. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, yeah, you get up to like I mentioned earlier, I'm about at that 70,000 mark on Blood Red 2. And the problem is, it's getting to the point it's time to wrap stuff up. And as I'm going, I'm just like, all right, what was the name of that street? So it's like, and I have a rule where I don't interrupt my flow. So if I'm getting my writing time in, it's like, I forgot that dude's name. ####. We'll find that later. Yeah. You know, did I give him an M4 or what is this guy rolling with right now? Does he have a vest on? Does he not? I'm like, oh crap. You know, because I'll outfit everybody and then be like, well, this is making it way too easy. So I got to go back and carve out. I'm like, nah, you don't need an M4 right now. This is, you're losing right now. So get that out of there. It gives you a little too much firepower. I don't think your gun should work. You know, you've just been thrown into this. I think you only need one magazine because you were traveling, didn't plan on being here today. Right. So having to go back and take away or build up. But yeah, it's like, I have so many like highlights or hash points in my draft that I'm just like, it's all going back to it because I do it I keep a notebook. So I got the keyboard and then I got the notebook. So anytime I get a new character, boom, I just put them in there, new spot, new location, new gear. But at 70,000, it's, you know, 30 pages of notes at this point. It's like, correct. Yeah, we'll catch that on the edits.
I hear you.
Yeah. Yep. So, but yeah, so, all right. So we've got, the three novellas. Who was it? Okay, so what's that? The next one. I wanted to ask you about the FBI agent turned PI.
Mm-hmm.
Because you've spent time in the PI world, right?
I did. Yeah.
Yeah. So is it? I try to visualize that because I had a couple friends at the police department that went and tried that private investigator route, and
it's a tough business.
Within like a year, yeah, they're back, and you know, whatever rank they did have is now gone. You know, they're on midnight shift. But yeah, that just, it seems like it'd be a really hard transition going from the resources and the structure of, you know, of all places, the FBI, where, you know, call, you know, I need a G5, no problem, it'll be here in a minute. You know?
Yeah, that happens all the time.
Yeah.
For me, there, anyway,
there was, the director was always,
can pull that off.
Yeah, that was always my goal, was like, I just want to ride on the G5, yeah, not to get in trouble, because I've seen people get the G5 ride back to the Hoover building, but you know, a G5 ride for something I wasn't going to make the news for.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you, my last assignment, you said I was an SAC. I had one of the bureau pilots tell me, you ever need to get out there, boss, you let me know. We can get you out there, lickety split on the bureau plane. I said, negative. I will be driving myself out there. I am not getting on a bureau plane to go somewhere unless the director tells me.
Yep. And it, but yeah, I remember I was TDY at the NCTC, and they had like a short fuse thing to go pick somebody up and do a transfer. And I was like, oh, I'll do it. Cause they said, as soon as they said G5, I'm like, yeah, I'm in. Like, where are we going? And the guy's like, sit down, rookie.
Yeah.
Like, oh, it was worth a shot. You miss 100% of the shots you don't take. So you have three series that you're kicking off. How many of those are, well, I guess, I mean, four, if you count Area 51, right?
Cause you've got three. Yeah, it's okay. It's the R51 series, CJ Hawk, and then the newest one, Kiki Diaz.
Kiki Diaz. How far out are you planning these? Like, do you have multiple stages planned, or did you develop this character and be like, yeah, I can run with this? Or you know, how far out are you planning these?
Well, what I plan is in three book arcs, basically. I mean, and I'm open to going a lot longer than that, especially on CJ Hawk. If those books take off, if I can get the right agent, the right publisher, and even if I can, I mean, I've done a lot of exploring in the self-published world. I'm confident about it. I think it's really changed the industry. I've learned a lot from the novellas that I've published already. I mean, they're under a private label press, but it's effectively, you know, self-published. It's a press that I control. So I'm comfortable with that concept. And again, just thinking in three book arcs, and already having the ideas for a fourth Black Jack Morrison that I really think I can pull off maybe before the end of the year. I've got a really cool concept for a fourth CJ Hawk after the third one that I'm kind of working on now. I'm going to finish up the first Kiki Diaz novella, then I'll go back to finishing up the third CJ Hawk novel. So I was thinking three book arcs, and then if I can expand them past there, then I'll do so. Yeah. Depending on what becomes successful and what the readers want, that's really what matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Which ones hit? But it's funny. You mentioned the self-publishing versus the getting a publisher route, and I've done one that I just wanted to self-publish, and then I did not have the patience that you do, because you've got two and you're letting them float through editors and you're letting them. Right. I could ask you your rejection letter number, but it's
high. It's high. I mean, doing it yourself. Yeah. The editor I'm working with actually knows a lot of this editor has written successfully himself. In addition to being, an editor, he's a published author successfully. But before him, just shotgunning it to agents, it's tough. That's a tough business, as you know. Mm. I've had some soft interest from some minor presses in the CJ Hawk full length novels, but I don't want to go there. I mean, if my thought is, why would I go to a small press if I can be a small press? So I'm kind of keeping that in the back of my head.
Yeah, and with all the tools available to us at this point, it for me, and now that I'm approaching number eight and I've gone both roads, a small press to a medium press to doing it myself, nobody tells you about the business side when you get into this, and I can't stand talking business when we've got such cooler, more stuff to talk about, like creating characters and putting pen to paper. I think the hardest thing is getting that platform built. Like, you mentioned the guys with the big five, Carr and Baldacci and those guys, this just creating that swell is the hardest part. And I think anybody who figures that out is good to go, just creating that brand. But it's not something they teach you,
it's a time suck. That's the biggest awful part.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think to your point, the big five exists to sell those books from Baldacci and Jack Carr and, the Tom Clancy franchise and Vince Flynn, because that's what makes them money, not trying to discover a new author. They love to, but it's a tough business and it's changing quickly. So that's why I think there's so much room for people that are willing to do, something else, need their own press. The audio books, we're breaking away from Audible now, being the 100-pound, well, they're still the 800-pound gorilla, but you can go another way now with it. So,
And it's, and I'd never considered it before. I hadn't read a lot of novellas before. But the digestibility of that format, I think that's, with people being so, their attention spans are just gone, and it's just a matter of having every bit of media that's ever been created at your fingertips at every given time. That writing genre, it takes work, and to be able to sit down and hit up 25,000 words, 100 pages, you can do it without in some cases dedicating weeks or months at a time to it. And you can churn it out. You can keep putting out those stories and getting that buy-in from the audience. I'd never considered that until I got into yours. And it was pretty much, I saw Area 51 and I'm like, Area 51 in the 50s. Yep. I think I can do this.
I think they're making a comeback. In fact, there's a couple of podcasts out there. If people want to look them up, Google, and they're making a comeback because it's not something that the big five are interested in, because they don't want a hundred page book. They've got to have a 300-400-500 page book to make it worth their while to print, distribute, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But now that we're in a different world with, Kindle Unlimited and Scrivener and all the, it's easy to do that. And to your point, people are looking at him saying that I really like that. So I think we're going to see more and more novellas really coming on.
Yep. Yeah. I just think that for today's day and age, that's a great episodic way, movies are going away from the big screen and we're getting Amazon, eight episode features that give them more time to dive into the development, and you get to know your characters more. And, I'm of course talking that Carr series and Bosch, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But yep. the way that the guys at Amazon took Connolly's work and nailed it every single season was, I mean, it's, I don't think there's a better way to give an author, you know, to put an author up on screen than that, because they were able to actually dive in instead of compressing a 700 page book into a 120 page screenplay, you know?
Right. But that's an excellent point. If some of those Connelly books, and I'm not saying they should have been novellas because they're perfect, who's going to second guess Michael Connelly? But sometimes though, that Bosch series is so, he's had so many books out there that I don't think they'll make all of those books into a series because there's too many of them. So the novella is actually kind of a little mini series almost. It's almost like a TV season, you know, where you can just get, you know, 8 different Netflix videos and you've got, you know, kind of a summation of the story. So I kind of think I think we're going to see a lot more novellas.
Yep. Yeah. There's just, in my opinion, there's just more depth than trying to squeeze into 2 hours on screen. But yeah, as far as, there's a note. So we talked a little bit about the Area 51, the UFO thing. And since it's out there, what's your stance on UFOs at this point?
You know, the more I research it, and I did quite a bit of research, some of it before, and then some of it as I'm going along, because I want to be, you know, it's not factual because there's no facts in UFOs, but I want to be, you know, topical. So as I put in my author note at the end, I highly recommend the Rogan podcast. You know, Joe Rogan does 3 hours at a time when he does a podcast, and he's had some terrific guests on there that really have taken a deep dive into this. And if anything, it's mind expanding. It gives you know, so much information to just dwell on. And that's kind of where I'm at. I'm completely open to, you know, any scenario. I'm not a conspiracy theorist. Even if you read the books and you think this is wildly conspiratorial, I'm not. But having said that, I do think that there's, you know, there's room for debate on a lot of things. You know, I highly recommend any of those Joe Rogan podcasts where he brings guests on that talk about, you know, UFOs and, you know, all kinds of other phenomena. They're really good.
Yeah. I was
going to say, I one of the very first things I did, not in relation to this, but I had just read it a couple of years ago and then went back to it, was Annie Jacobson's book on Area 51. It's a very journalistic, and she's a terrific journalist. Everything she touches is like interesting and well-researched. She spends years on a topic, as she did on this one. And so that kind of planted the seed about the aura and the mystery about Area 51. And she's been on Rogan as well. Mm-hmm. So a terrific read for people that if you have an interest in Area 51 and you want to kind of know what's out there factually that she's been able to uncover by reams and reams of government documents, FOI requests, and things like that. It's a terrific read.
Yeah, there was a Hulu series that she was on, and you know, she's so intelligent and cited, and her references are, you know, her sources are vetted. That it makes you think. I mean, I would call myself an objective skeptic. Like, mm-hmm. you know, is there evidence of anything? Nah, not at all. But would the world be cooler if there was those things? Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I have a standing offer to that I would allow myself to be abducted as long as I get to drive. That's pretty much where I stand.
Let me take a first spin. So I don't know if you want
to. Oh, I can handle it. Yep. So we've been going for a pretty good while. I wanted to, though, you know, if you've listened before, you know, if I get veterans on or law enforcement on, you know, I want to reach out to the community a little bit. So you've had work, you know, you've worked on the city side, you've worked on the federal side. If there's you know, put it down to, you know, 20-year-old kid getting out of college, not sure, you know, do I, you know, go on to grad school or do I join the police department? What would your advice be to somebody trying to decide if they want to go into law enforcement today?
Yeah, this is a tough one today because law enforcement's taken it on the chin here the last 3 years almost, and unnecessarily, in my opinion. Do things happen? Yeah, bad things happen. It's they you can't control everything that goes on in that environment. You all know that. But grad school versus going into law enforcement, you're going to learn more about human nature, life, the way the world works in law enforcement. You'll learn the way that academia works in grad school. So, I mean, I obviously I spent most of my adult life, all of my adult life in it. So, you know, we need good people to do this. It's tough right now. And my heart's out to these departments, good departments across the country that can't retain people, can't attract people because, you know, they don't want to put themselves into positions, not just life and death decisions. We accept that going in. That's, you hate to say it, that's the easy part, but yeah. You know, how am I going to be looked at after this? How, you know, what's going to come rain down on me for doing my job, for doing what I've been asked to do? You know, is it safer to, you know, go into real estate or insurance or something like that? Not safer from a personal injury standpoint. You know, cops and federal agents take that on. It's the whole dynamic. What's going to happen to my family? You know, a friend of mine, good friend of mine, who retired assistant director, talked about this whole issue of, you know, indemnity and law enforcement officers being immune from prosecution when they're doing their job as they're supposed to be, not when they step away and they're acting outside the scope, but when they do the job they're supposed to be doing. And he said it perfectly. I'm willing to put myself, you know, in harm's way, to be financially ruined, to have my personal integrity questioned. I'm not willing to do that for my family. And it's really something you need to think about. But, you know, I hope, you know, kids 20, 21, 22 years old do that. I mean, to this day, I look back and on the fact that as a 22-year-old kid, literally, the citizens of the community I worked on gave me a badge and a gun and said, go do things and take care of us. Pretty awesome. So.
Yeah. Like you said, I don't think there's any profession out there that will give you an understanding of human behavior faster or more efficiently than being on a patrol car. No. And the feeling of pulling it off when things go really well or really crazy is you can't beat it anywhere. But yeah, the idea of, you know, if they were to take away, you know, immunity for police officers, right. that puts you in the realm of paying doctors' liability insurance. And the city governments and state governments can't afford it. They won't pay cops for, you know, to cover liability, and they won't pay them for their education. They won't professionalize, you know, give them a living wage in most places. I worked in the South, and it was, you know, New York State and Connecticut up in New England, those unions have the wages locked down, but you get down South and it's a wild shot. It's a personally driven, because you want to do good things, like you said, but yeah, all those other things I can't even imagine that. I never had to worry about that, you know, that was fixed. It was, you know, precedent, you know? So yeah, there's a lot to consider.
I don't think people understand immunity. When I see people popping off about taking away police immunity, what they don't understand is you have immunity to the extent you're operating under your general orders and in the scope of your authority. When you waver from that, when you're, you know, like the officers in Minneapolis, they weren't operating under the scope of authority. They stepped out of it. That makes them personally liable. And that's the way it ought to be. What immunity does is give officers immunity from being sued for writing a traffic ticket. Every time you give somebody a speeding ticket, if you didn't have, you know, immunity, then theoretically on your own dime, you're hiring an attorney to go into court to explain to a judge or jury as to why you gave somebody a ticket, and the system wouldn't work.
Yep. And it wouldn't cost the plaintiffs much, you know, but you have to defend yourself every time. Correct. When the department decides not to.
The other thing they don't understand is that the department's not off the hook. So, you know, if you are operating outside the scope of your authority, it doesn't mean that the department can't be sued, and often are. And by the way, they're the ones that have more money. Well, the taxpayers that live in that jurisdiction do. Police officers have a lot of money. You write checks to defendants. No,
that's not happening. Yeah. But I, you know, nothing came of it, but I remember the day I got served, and it was like, oh man, you know, and, but it, luckily there was a captain there being like, no, you're good. I'm like, really? You know, so nothing came of it, folks. Nothing came of it. Not going into it, but check that box. So, yeah, I appreciate it. And I know that on your socials, you've got fxreagan.com, at fxreagan on Twitter and Instagram. And man, your schedule is full. You got we got stuff coming out in June, and then in the fall, like there's a lot coming out. I would say anytime you want to come back and talk over some stuff, I'm in.
I appreciate it. Yeah. I really appreciate you having me here. It's been terrific. Love the podcast and keep listening.
I appreciate it. And yeah, thanks for joining me. And like I said, hit me up anytime.
All right. Talk later, John.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Good night.